editorial role is rocky. I'm ready to try the next mile to bring sight to the blind man and sound to the left child. We will survive in this country wilderness, swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish, journalist, specialist, predator and survivalist, spitting heaven's fire from his lips, burning slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. With all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream your program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And before you leave that page, just hit that like button for me. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for an Awakening Media is there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening Media. Interesting articles that you can download, listen at later times, or share with your friends. And check out that Time for an Awakening marketplace in partnership with the B.B. Toomey. Always interesting content being posted daily in the marketplace. African language classes, classes on economics, social systems, health, and many, many more taught by professors on both the continent and the diaspora. So check out the marketplace on timeforanawakening.com in partnership with the B.B. Toomey. Make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, along with our regular Freestyle Friday program, we have a special guest joining us, activist and educator in the Philadelphia area. Brother Akil Parker is with us to share with us some new innovative methods that he's using this year in a lot of his classes. And we'll be right back to get the program started with our special guest, Brother Akil Parker. And we'll do that after we come back, after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:23, a little bit late getting started today. 8:23 in the city of Philadelphia. And before we get started with our program, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia, 7th and R Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard. Brother Richard, are you there?
Can you hear me?
I hear you now.
Oh. I'm getting used to I'm kind of thrown a little bit, the format that they throw me. You know, I'm one of them kind of people, you know, I get to a thing and you got to stay to it or I get all messed up.
Yeah. So. Well, sometimes you ain't the only one. I see the new format here that they kind of laid out, but get used to it. Yeah.
Yeah. But before we start, Elliot, I do. I was just going over some of the things, you know, looking at the Bahamas, and I just wanted to, you know, once again, it seems like every year around this time we have to look to some kind of devastation that's going on from natural events that has, you know, talking about getting used to things where things change. And, you know, the hurricane that went through Dorian, in the Bahamas, you know, seemed to have had a devastating effect on a lot of people. I just wanted to, you know, let it be known that we're conscious of the need for support. Not too long ago was Puerto Rico, and last year was Bombarda, Barbara. So it's natural events changes, you know, requires us to know what it is to need each other, to rebuild, and recognize that things aren't going to always stay the same just because we built it that way.
Yeah, I think right now the death total was like 30 people, but the way some of those some of the footage looks from the way that the island looks, I know it's a lot more people, because they said it's thousands of people that are still missing. So I know that death toll count is just an early estimate, or maybe early confirmation. But, you know, it just shows that we don't have necessarily set up a way where we can aid our people directly.
Right.
We have to go through other channels that this country has set up, whether it's March of Dimes or other aid organizations. And sometimes that aid doesn't get to the people that needs to have it. So those are some of the things that we can kind of think about sometimes, and look forward to putting in place, along with the looking towards our people being a sovereign people again in the future. Those things go towards making a people a full functioning nation, being able to aid people when it's needed, and come to a people's rescue when they need brothers and sisters. So I understand exactly what you're saying, Brother Richard, and the need is there. Hopefully if people do donate, they can donate through other channels. Being that the Bahamas is a island where our people are, and some people know people that are from the Bahamas or might still have relatives in the Bahamas, it's ways that we can donate to our people directly instead of going through other channels. Sometimes churches have things set up where they can get donations directly to people there and other ways. And even if you send money through different channels, it's ways that we can get aid directly to our people. So I understand what you're saying.
Definitely needed, and that's why Brother Parker, when he was presenting, once said he had he wanted to explore. I'm gonna call it explore with the Time for Waking Listening Awareness. His approach of him being an educator and a teacher, and I was thinking about, you know, Brother Akil being if you look at his posts, he's always raising challenging questions for those of us who are, you know, looking and listening and trying to, just figure out. But as a math teacher, you can see that his logic in it. What he's saying, he's developing this teaching method. I'm calling it a method until he explains it to us, of providing the need for the history to be intertwined with the mathematics, as far as students being able to not just learn math, but to learn history. And I might be butchering his theory and his methodology and his intent, but as an opening, it just seems that's what I'm getting the sense of. That's what it's about. And we talk about places like that need assistance, and people need assistance, African people needing assistance. It's important to understand how important history and math is, the basis of identity. And I call it engineering, social engineering, you know, because we don't really see sometimes that our organizational relationship is a technology. And, you know, basis of all technology is mathematics, and basis of nature is mathematics. So I just wanted to just use that to see what Brother Hakeel has to share with us in relationship to his teaching style, and also what he's learning from his students as he implores this here methodology.
It's always good to have a Brother Parker. The door is always open to him. Activist and educator, Brother Keel Parker, is with us this evening. Brother Keel, how are you, sir?
I'm good, brother. Good, brother. I'm glad to be here.
Listen, I'm always glad to have you on with us. I enjoy a lot of your posts in social media, because whenever I run across some of your posts, it's always some provocative thought. You can't just read your posts and just go by them. You have to think about what is being stated, and if you give a response, you kind of you better think about your response before you respond. So I'm always glad to see your posts pop up in my timeline. A lot of times I'll repost them or steal a thought from whatever you're saying and look for some articles based on some of your posts. So I'm always happy to have you as one of the social media contacts that we use. But
well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that, brother. I mean, one of the main reasons for the type of posting I do most of the time, because, you know, sometimes I can be a little silly and a little goofy sometimes, but most of the time, I try to take a proactive approach, because, you know, I've been a person that has been had a lot of complaints about kind of the status quo of conversations, mm-hmm. at least in the mainstream media, or some people say the Eurostream media, about Black people. In terms of like them trying to dictate what we should be concerned about or what we should be talking about. So I've been a person that's like been very like critical of that. And then I had to realize that, you know, what I have to do is like counter it with, you know, a different dialogue. So I try to use my social media as a platform to, you know, give an alternative. Like, let's have some more, like, you know, if the Eurostream media is trying to push us this way and get us to have these conversations about these insignificant and trivial things, then let's talk about something that's more meaningful, you know, something that's really is going to matter in terms of how we're going to be able to feed, clothe, and shelter our children and our grandchildren, you know, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, and some things that we need to be thinking about now, some things that we perhaps didn't think about enough in the past 50 years or the past 100 years or so. And I kind of try to treat it like a classroom. I think I left the school district of Philadelphia a year ago, mm-hmm. and being in a self-contained classroom, which I was in for about 14 to 15 years. Well, at that point, 14 years. I miss kind of being in a self-contained classroom all day long, like with the young brothers and the young sisters, just having those real conversations. So I think like Facebook is like what I realized one day, like Facebook and Instagram to an extent, has become like my outlet to kind of get that energy and like trying to kind of have those conversations with people. Because I was just constantly just trying to develop the critical thinking of my students, sometimes just ask them questions. And then, you know, their responses, like you said, like you mentioned things that I learned from my students. I would learn a lot from my students, you know, from their responses. And they would hit me back with things that I had never thought of before, I never considered. And then I got into the habit of just doing it on purpose and being intentional, because I knew that one of these young boys, one of these young sisters was going to put me on with something I hadn't even considered. So that's why I had to put the information out there or put the question out there and pose it to them, you know. So I appreciate that you appreciate what I've been doing.
Brother Keel, talk about some of the things that you wanted to present tonight in reference to some of the innovation. Now, you said that you left the school district. Are you teaching private courses or things of that nature, tutoring, or how are you moving around in the classroom now?
Well, kind of all of the above.
Okay.
What you just said. I've been a I left the school district of Philadelphia in the end of the school year, June of 2018.
Okay.
And then I have a tutoring and education and math tutoring and educational consulting business called All This Math. So that's why a lot of times you see my hashtag All This Math, right? So I do some private tutoring. I do some group tutoring. I've been doing some work with some homeschool collectives, and that's been very fruitful as well.
Okay.
In terms of just getting that experience and just kind of seeing for myself that, you know, I'm one of these people that talks real heavy about Black people starting independent, you know, schools and a network of independent schools. Well, it's enabled me, working with the homeschool collectives has enabled me to really kind of see in real time, like, how this can be done, even if it's on a small scale right now. You know, I mean, and it's fine that it's on a small scale, because, you know, even, you know, Malcolm and other people too, but Malcolm in the Battle of the Bully, he talked about, you know, Woolworth didn't start out what it was, you know, back then, you know, when it was, you know, a lot of people don't know about Woolworth, but, you know, it kind of would be comparable to a Walmart. You know, even if we bring it forward to today, we can say that, you know, Walmart didn't start out what it is now. You know, it started out as a mom and pop operation, or GMAC, like Malcolm talked about, didn't start out what it was. It started out as a small operation. So we could do the same thing with the schools. And I think the homeschool collectives that I've come in contact with, run by some concerned Black parents that are just like, you know, I want something different for my children. And they've kind of taken a proactive approach and like embrace some Kuji Chakalia, you know, some self-determination and said, you know, and, you know, this is what I want for my children or my child or my children. And this is just what we're going to do. And I've appreciated the opportunity to kind of help out with that because, you know, a lot of the parents are like, they don't feel equipped to, you know, be the math instructor, you know, or the math facilitator for their children. And that's fine too. And I think that might be another thing that kind of hinders our development of independent educational spaces, is the feeling by parents that if they don't feel that they can be the actual instructor, then they feel like they can't do it. But I think another part that I've learned is seeing how, you know, because I mean, there are high school principals, middle school principals that can't teach every subject that's offered in the building. Okay. But one of their skill sets should be to identify and recruit the talent that can deliver that content to the young sisters and brothers from the community. So essentially, like within a homeschool collective, these mothers and these fathers, these aunts and these uncles, these grandparents are essentially doing that. They're serving as school principals for their for their own children and for the children that are, you know, with all the children that are in that collective. And I really appreciate that. So that's one thing I've been doing. I started out teaching in the education. I got an opportunity to teach in the education department at LaSalle University. So this is my second year doing that, teaching math methods courses, two of them. Well, one math methods course, the other course is a course for freshmen to prepare them for the practice exam. You know, it's just kind of like a strict math prep course, basically, for the practice. And this year, something I'm really happy about was Cheney University needed a teacher in their education department. So, you know, I'm teaching a math methods course over there as well, which kind of has been really something I've wanted to do for a long time, teach at HBCU. You know, kind of one of the things I kind of had a dream. I don't like that word. I kind of think it's thrown around too loosely, but an aspiration. I say aspiration is to teach at an HBCU campus and kind of contribute to kind of developing HBCUs in a way that they really can be the spaces that we can utilize to lead us towards some independent nation building. Because oftentimes the powers that be may hinder them from being those spaces when they, even though they do have the potential, and I think they have more, I think in many cases, not all, but in many cases, they do have more potential to prepare our youth for nation building, independent nation building, than the HWCUs or the historically white colleges and universities. But I just hope that being in that space, I can contribute to helping the HBCUs to become those type of spaces that I can prepare our youth and our young adults for nation building. Because I think that's the real solution. Not just, there's so much emphasis, as we all know, so much emphasis on us just trying to fit in and, you know, be good Americans and get our, you know, do our George Jefferson thing, get a piece of the pie. But that doesn't work for the collective. You know, it just doesn't work for the collective. It's been proven time and time again that we have to be thinking like long term in terms of some type of nation building. And what it looks like, you know, those details are very important, and that's the work that has to be done too, that analysis. But at least the goal has to be there. We have to be clear about that goal. I've been doing some adjunct work, developing my tutoring business and educational consulting business, and doing like some different speaking and, you know, speaking at different conferences and presenting papers and presentations. And that kind of, most recently I was at the Teaching Black History Conference out in Columbia, Missouri. And I actually got to attend that along with my father. My father presented did a presentation as well, not on the same day, but I presented on that Friday. I believe he presented on that Saturday. My father's a long time, been an educator for almost 40 years.
Okay.
And so he presented. So that was a like a treat, I guess, you know, for me to like be out there with him. And I presented on this concept called histomatics. That was one of the things I wanted to talk about, and I'm trying to develop this more. And because presenting at that conference gave me an opportunity to kind of formalize and try to package something that I realized I've been doing or been developing throughout my entire teaching career, which is kind of trying to merge mathematics with history or historiography. And it speaks to a larger issue of, again, European-centered education versus African-centered education. And there's the concept of compartmentalizing. I think we don't ask, well, why do disciplines have to be compartmentalized? You know, and the youth, you know, even myself growing up, going to different schools, you know, you sit in this room for an hour and the bell rings. You talk about this particular idea or this discipline for an hour, whether it's maybe English literature, and then a bell rings. And the next period, you go sit in another room, do mathematical equations for another hour, then a bell rings. And, you know, it's real, real Pavlovian. And then we go into these different rooms and everything seems like disjointed and disconnected. And I have this theory that because we're educationally socialized in that manner, that when we become adults, or even not even when we become adults, but even when we're still youth, and there's a problem in the community, which is difficult for us to recognize what the cause of the problem is, because we always kind of operate on this notion that one thing don't got nothing to do with the other. When in fact, everything has to do with everything. Everything is interconnected. So I think that us being socialized that way, where it's like, you know, everything's compartmentalized. Like we over here doing this, and then we over here doing this. And this thing we did at 9 a.m. in the morning has nothing to do with what we're doing at 12 p.m. in the afternoon or at last period at 2 p.m. in the afternoon. I think that affects our thinking. So I think that might be, I don't know, it might be some type of, I don't know if the correct term is neuroplasticity or whatever it might be, but I think it affects just the way we view the world we live in and the way we view problems and potential solutions. And I mean, it's like the transitive property in mathematics, like transitive property, if A equals B, B equals C, then A equals C. We get stuck thinking, okay, well, A equals B and B equals C. And we really think that A don't got nothing to do with C. You know what I'm saying? So, and that's another reason why I promote mathematics. I think mathematics can help to develop our critical thinking skills. Mathematics is kind of like a methodology. Just thinking mathematically is of a great benefit, which also shows, and this is something that we pick up from like studying Amos Wilson, where he talks about the political necessity for Black people and Black children especially to not excel at mathematics. Because then we say, well, what would the world look like, you know, if you don't have this permanent underclass, because all these Black people are able to excel in mathematics and then in turn in the science fields and all the so-called like STEM fields, you know, then what happens? You know, that upsets the status quo tremendously. And, you know, Brother Elliot, when you mentioned, we're talking about the Bahamas and the natural disaster, and we're talking about the full functioning nation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, definitely, I felt that when you said that, because I was thinking about how we can't have a fully functioning
nation unless we have a command over the mathematics and the ability to do engineering and develop technology for ourselves.
Right.
And to, you know, to develop a society, you know, in that way. So if we're talking about nation building and we're serious, then we got to become even more serious about teaching our children mathematics and then how we go about doing it. Because like the STEM, a lot of the STEM initiatives are kind of cute, and you have a lot of white liberals throwing money at that and kind of perpetuating this type of tokenism within the Black community.
Okay.
You know, because I was one of those Black students that got opportunities and went to summer programs and, you know, went to this program, this after-school program, and got exposure to, you know, a lot of mathematics, but a lot of my peers didn't. So it was like that, you know, it kind of creates that Negro exceptionalism,
you know. But then it's a problem because the mathematics, you know, I was culturally grounded, but I wasn't as culturally grounded as I needed to be when I was young, and in like elementary school and middle school, and then in high school, because I saw math as a tool of assimilationism. So it was almost like academic skin bleaching, you know, because it's like, yeah, I'm doing well in math, all my mathematics courses, and I'm known as a you know, within my family as a good math student, but I'm seeing it, and I'm taught that mathematics basically is the domain of Europeans, or not the domain of Africans. And if I excel at it, then I'm like, okay, see, I get to go over here and be an honorary European. And I think a lot of our children fall into this trap as well, and they never get out of it. And that's why a lot of them end up, you know, with all these technical skills and this great ability and academic ability, but they're kind of useless to us as a race, because they're not looking at it as though, you know, this is something that, you know, belongs to our people. This is something that our ancestors in ancient Kemet developed in the first place, that, you know, the Europeans came down and basically stole or learned and then took it back to Europe and marketed it as their own. Like, that's why, you know, oftentimes when I'm in geometry, I talk about the so-called Pythagorean theorem, you know, because Pythagoras studied in Kemet for 20 years. And like Theophile Obenga, he writes about that. He researched that and writes about that, you know. So it's, the theory shouldn't even have that name, you know what I mean? But actually, it's cool if it has that name. I mean, if they want to call it that, because that's their guy, mm-hmm. then that's fine. But, you know, we have African people that developed that prior to him, and we can call it a different name.
You know? So Brother Akil, when you just contextualize the importance of math and then explained, you know, the historical genealogy of, especially using like the example of geometry, is this a part of the process when you're saying that has to occur for your now say it again so I get I'm bad with words.
Histomatics
in the sense of being able to, even though you're doing a formula, always being able to show some historical reference that is that doesn't make you just, as you said, a tool. Because I appreciate the way you laid it out. You kind of, and you excel in math, you don't even know the historical reference. You're just doing the formula, so you don't recognize how it relates to anything. And are you saying this histomatics is to be able to, as an instructor, as a teacher, to be able to, while you're instructing on the method that a student must learn in order to do a problem, that history, incorporating history in that, how are you incorporating those two? That, I guess that's what I'm trying to get to.
Well, definitely. So, like, man, the ultimate goal is, like, I think if it's done correctly, and I'm still, like I said, I'm still developing this and still mm-hmm. formalizing it, but if it's done correctly, the student actually wouldn't even know if they're in a math course or in a history course, if it's done correctly. Because there will be so much balance between, okay, we're using formulas and we're being very intentional and we're being rigorous with the mathematics that we're doing, but, you know, what are we talking about? We're talking about these, you know, historical events that took place, and we're using those for like our word problems. And this is the application, you know, we're talking about, all the, you know, the wealth. Like if we look at like a book, like, by Osagyefo, Kwame Nkrumah, Neo-colonialism, The Last Stage of Imperialism, and how he really outlines and details how much wealth and quantifies, right? He wasn't just anecdotal, which was like, when I was reading that, I was like, wow, this is powerful. Because a lot of books are anecdotal, and that's cool. But Nkrumah took it a step further and really quantified, you know, like a businessman, like an economics major, an economics PhD. He's breaking down like, okay, this is how much DuPont stole. This is how much bauxite this European company stole from between this period and that period. And this is how much tin was stolen. This is how much gold was stolen. This is how much rubber was taken from the Congo. And, you know, he's doing that. So whenever we're dealing with quantities, then we're dealing with mathematics. So then we can teach these concepts of how to use these mathematical tools. And at the same time, we can let them know that, okay, this is really, and we don't even have to talk about like some of the so-called losses that Africa suffered. We can talk about the wins too, because we can talk about, you know, slave rebellions. You know, we can talk about those things, and we can talk about just our existence prior to the Miafia. You know, and what I also realized is like there's nothing really. This is not really that unique, and it's not really a brand new thing. Because if you I do SAT prep as well, and if you really study and really examine some of the SAT questions, they're all word problems.
Right.
And a lot of the word problems, what they're doing is they're also teaching and promoting European and white culture through their problems. I mean, this was the argument, you know, years ago when I was even younger, like, you know, the SAT is culturally biased. And it is culturally biased. So what I'm saying is, like, we have to create our own mathematical problems, create our own curricula that, you know, where we have our own cultural bias, because we should, you know, it's ours. We should be teaching our children from our own cultural standpoint, no matter what the subject is, whether it's mathematics, whether it's chemistry, whether it's biology. And then when we get even deeper, we get into just the philosophy within these subjects, like, and what they're used for, because then we can start really having some deeper conversations about African-centered worldview versus European-centered worldview. Because a lot of the ways in which we use these subjects would change dramatically and drastically.
Yeah, now what you raise in that thought is, would that require the instructor, teacher, educator to be not only just to be grounded there, and I call it technical skills, you know, whether you're dealing with grammar or math, these are, in the end, they're just technical skills. But aren't mm-hmm. you saying then they would have to have some a broader grasp of not the culture, the African culture, to be able to intertwine those examples as they're developing their lesson plan, you know, I understand is a major thing in public education or even in their delivery as a teacher to get across the ideals, but still use technical things as you use the example of SATs. Doesn't it require those educators to have that?
They definitely would. So, and I'll give you an example. So over the years, I've become more intentional about kind of developing, I was kind of developing histomatics before I even knew I was developing it, right? More recently, when Toni Morrison passed away, rest in peace to Toni Morrison, I sat back and I said, well, you know, damn, like, you know, I have a copy of The Bluest Eye, but I've never read it. You know, I started it many years ago, but I never actually read it. So me and my wife, she had read it years ago. So we took it as an opportunity to kind of have like a couples like study group. So we both read The Bluest Eye. But what I was doing, like, and I've developed this habit, I always look as I'm reading, it doesn't matter what I'm reading, I'm always looking for like potential math problems, you know. It's kind of like how like rappers do. Like, I remember rapper Papoose was saying, like, you know, sometimes when he goes into the booth, he's thinking about just his daily experiences. Like the things that he saw that day from the time he woke up until the time he got to the studio, right? So as a math practitioner, I'm always looking for like potential math problems, like in any situation that I'm in. Like, I'd be driving in my car in North Philly, going somewhere, sitting in my house, walking down the street, watching television, listening to something on the radio. I'm always thinking about looking for potential math problems. Sometimes stuff will just hit me and I have to, like, you know, take my phone out and go to my notes app, and I have this folder called Do Nows, because I used to create Do Now, what's called a Do Now assignment. It's like the drill or the warm-up assignment that my students would do when they first come into the class. And, you know, I would just come up with these different problems, like, you know, dealing with different quantities and things that are very culturally relevant, right? But back to The Bluest Eye, what I did was I did like a mini project. I made notes of all of these different potential math problems that could be found in The Bluest Eye that math teachers could use. You know, also, so it kind of contextualizes the book better, right, even more so. And then, like, you're doing mathematics at the same time. Like, you're studying Toni Morrison and reading Bluest Eye. You're reading about Pacola Breedlove and, you know, the different characters. But then you're doing mathematics at the same time. You're doing some algebra at the same time. So I came up with, it was like the all this math in The Bluest Eye. That was like 20 questions, like 20 different examples. I took quotes from the book. So, like, just like, well, I remember when I was in school, I was in high school or middle school and in English class, and we had to read a book, and then, you know, the teacher would pull out excerpts of the book, but it was just about the content. And then we would be asked to, like, think about, think about the content, you know. But now I'm saying, in addition to thinking about the content, we got to think about the mathematics, like, within the content. So it's kind of like, almost like a killing two birds with one stone type of thing. You know, you're going to, and then, like, thinking about something that you traditionally wouldn't think about in a mathematical way, but now you are thinking about it in a mathematical way. So and I think that was, like, reinforces it.
And I had to bring up this point, you know, as Brother Keel brings that up, and as you're working through, you know, this process, it reminds me when we talk about looking at after Reconstruction, because it seemed like a lot of the educators, or even when you're saying you're at Cheney now, it always, when I tell people that, you know, in what we were considered eighth grade, they were doing geometry. That was college level, fourth year college level work that they were doing at Cheney or Institute of Colored Youth or African Institute by the time they got to the eighth grade.
Right.
And at the same time, they were incorporating what they were aware of now, the historical understanding, identity context that I think I hear you speaking to. So, and during Reconstruction, those to be able to move education population in the magnitude they did over a short period of time, those educators also were, if I understand you right, were incorporating the cultural or historical understanding that they had at that time. And by that time, they were, by reading the Bible, they were making the connections that the Egyptians were African. I mean, right. So they were, those teachers weren't just teaching, and grammar wasn't just teaching mathematics or even how just to build houses, which was the basis of engineering. They were also incorporating in students that identity building, if I understand you right.
Yeah, and I definitely agree and can attest to that. And also, like, in terms of, like, just kind of marrying the disciplines and marrying the subjects, I remember I was talking to one of my colleagues, because I left this out. I also teach at an alternative education program that's actually run or overseen by the School District of Philadelphia called One Bright Ray. And One Bright Ray I teach in a night school, basically. So I teach geometry and algebra 2 in a night school at One Bright Ray. And it's in the Strawberry Mansion campus and on the fifth floor, where Mansion still has the first four floors. I'm not sure about the future of Strawberry Mansion High School, but I need to look into that, actually, by the way. But anyway, I was talking to one of my colleagues about my experiences when I was in middle school and we would diagram sentences. And I remember I always really enjoyed diagramming sentences. And I think the reason was because it reminded me of solving an equation. I enjoyed mathematics and I enjoyed algebra in middle school. But in my English class, when we started diagramming sentences, breaking down the different parts, the different clauses, the different parts of speech, subject, the predicate, right, the prepositions, the adverbs, the adjectives, I really enjoyed that because it was like I was kind of breaking apart a sentence and looking at it the same way that I looked at an equation. Like, okay, this is, you know, this is this part, this is this term, this is other term, this is negative, this is positive, you know, and I was kind of looking at it through the same type of lens. And, you know, I always thought that was, you know, helpful.
It's interesting because Brother Burton, who was an elder who taught at PASSEP, and I understand you were teaching Nkrumah at PASSEP for one or a couple of semesters there, and
we still had it. Well, we can't teach Kwame Ture without teaching Nkrumah, but you know, but officially it was Kwame Ture speaks.
And one thing that Brother Burton always emphasized to us was that every sentence has is only seven parts of speech, and every sentence had is one part of speech. So right. You can, as you're saying, you can break it down to that degree, which made me understand the point that you're making, that it is mathematics. And then when, you know, you look at ancient civilization and you look at the pyramids being built and the whole thing of geometry being the basis of the science. And, you know, you get to understand that we understood, even in growing agriculture, everything has science. Therefore, everything is, has order or has some kind of formula or mathematical equation. Now, I can't do it. I'm a professor. Elliot, I just passed 1 and 1 is 2. So I ain't, you know, I don't want nobody to believe I understand what's going on. You know, they kill you, got that. But, I always thought it was important for us to be enriched by not just knowing that Africans really figured this out over, you know, over thousands of years. But I mean, when we look at those, what's that, the Shango bones, being able to chart, you know, the mathematical bones and that charted time, and in order to be able to do things or to recognize the moon, the 28, you know, the whole lunar calendar period, those kind of things, like you said, aren't really taught to us to be able not just to inspire us, but to understand how grounded and interconnected things are. Even in our oppression, so that we can be able to do the critical thinking skills. So I understand where you're going with this, and I'm down is the question of, well, have you had, what is the feedback students have given to this approach as you're developing it?
Well, my students over time, I delivered the presentation at the Teaching Black History Conference, but like I said, it's kind of something I've been doing organically over the years. And the students' reaction is always, you should have been an African-American history teacher. So I feel like, and actually I made a Facebook post about this the other day, maybe yesterday or the day before that. I think it was yesterday, actually. You know, a sister was a little frustrated, and like she walked out of the class saying that, you know. But I realized that by her saying that, then that shows that what I'm trying to do is actually working. You know, because she's, you know, because we're talking about math methods, and we're in there, we're talking about, you know, how to, you know, teach young people how to find the least common denominator when you're adding or subtracting two fractions, right? So that's what we're talking about. But then within that, you know, we're dealing with the numbers, and we can have a conversation about, you know, something that's related to Africa or something that's related to our experience as African people in the United States or in North Philly or in West Philly, you know? So they, you know, they're listening and they're catching on to that. But again, it's that they're conditioned to be so compartmentalized. So there's like a discomfort, and you know, it's like, I don't know whether it's I don't know. Maybe for some people, and I don't know where I've heard this before, but it sounds like something that I might have read somewhere. But maybe there's like a psychic trauma that's associated with. Well, I know there's a psychic trauma associated with our history because of the way the way it's been marketed by so many people. So a lot of us don't even want to deal with it. Because I think about that comment that I should have been an African-American history teacher. And with some students, it's, you know, it's all in good nature. And they're kind of like paying me a compliment, kind of trying to say, well, you know, you're versatile. Like you have this, you know, this knowledge in different subjects. Like you're pluridisciplinary, right? But there's some people I think will get a little like annoyed. Like, you know, I just want to solve some equations. I just want to, you know, do geometry. Like, why are we in here talking about all this black stuff? You know, we're supposed to be talking about geometry. But, the young brother, the young sister might not understand, like, the geometry is black stuff. You know what I mean? But the thing is, it's like, you know, our children are conditioned to try to be capitalists or lackeys of capitalism. And with that comes this pursuit of money, money over everything, and money above all, and money becomes the guide, right, for them. So if it was a math class and, you know, the teacher's telling them how to get money and how to make money, you won't get that complaint from a lot of the students. A lot of the students won't sit back and say, wait, what's going on here? Like, you're telling us how to get money. You're telling us how to, like, you know, increase our income, like, right now in real time. And, you know, they're not going to make that complaint. Like, oh, you should have been the personal finance teacher, you know? Now, if it's a student that's trying to pay homage or pay a compliment to the teacher, that they're impressed by their knowledge base, the diversity of their knowledge base, then that they might make that comment. But the student that's like annoyed, like, you know, I came in, I just want to learn math. So it shows that it really is deeper than just I think it even goes deeper than just the compartmentalization factor. It's that, you know, you've kind of triggered them in a way. When you talk about that black stuff, because a lot of us have been conditioned to think that the reason that we have our problem is because we're black. And this gets into the Bobby Wright. It's like, you know, the psychopathic racial personality. It's like, no, the reason that we have problems is not because we're black. The reason we have problems is because of the way other groups of people are treating us because we're black. So we shouldn't have to internalize the responsibility for a lot of the problems we suffer from. Some things we should take responsibility for, but overall, just the fact that we're black is not the problem. It's not the fundamental root issue. And speaking of triggers, I can get into, I've kind of organized this into a framework with five elements, right? I kind of like summarize the five elements for you, if I will. Mm-hmm. So the first element is numerical triggers. And what numerical triggers means is, if we want to talk about events that took place, or just, we can use quantities, right? So like a lot of people, when they hear the date or the year 1954, first, if you know, some of us, if we've studied certain things, first thing that comes to mind is Brown versus Board of Education, Topeka, Kansas, right? So we can create mathematical problems in a classroom, examples where either 1,954 is one of the numbers that's used in that problem, or 1,954 might be the answer to that problem or the solution to that problem. And then once we get to that number, then the teacher, they would need to be well-versed in this as well. They start having a conversation about Brown versus Board, 1954, Charles Hamilton Houston, Thurgood Marshall, you know, what the original intent was. You know, talk about Chief Justice Earl Warren and his racist position, or his racist opinion that he offered, right? Basically saying that, black children can't learn in schools with black children, right? You gotta go be in school with white people in order for you to learn, which is just inherently racist, right? But we can talk about all that in a math class, a so-called math class or a histomatics course, right? And then hopefully, the idea is that when we do this enough, any child or any, you know, even when they become an adult, they're like, you know, when they hear those numbers, they see those numbers, they start thinking about, you know, historical events that took place. Like 381 is another example. 381 is documented number of days that the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955 lasted for. But then, you know, if you create a problem, 381 is going to be your answer, you know, or one of the numbers within the problem or within the equation. And then, Now you open the door. Now we can have a conversation about the Montgomery bus boycott. And we can talk about Rosa Parks. But then we got to be careful. We make sure we have a more robust conversation about Rosa Parks, and not just that she was just some random lady that just didn't give up her seat. That she was already a civil rights activist and already was involved with the NAACP well before that. You know, which is often not the way she's framed in a lot of typical like historical sources. You know. So that's the first element, the numerical triggers. Element two would be the African-centered word problems and applications. So this is like, you know, a lot of the do now assignments that I would do when I was at Overbrook for my last 2 years in the Philadelphia school district. And I would just create word problems. It's different word problems that are culturally relevant. And that ties into this kind of more current movement for culturally responsive pedagogy and culturally responsive curriculums. A lot of people around the country, smart and dedicated black people are doing around the country, you know, in terms of trying to teach the teachers to be better at what they're doing and, you know, making their lessons and making their curriculum more culturally responsive to black children.
And, you know, I have to interject with that, if I'm correct with this, because when that push of creating that culturally responsive curriculum was trying to be pushed within the institution, the public education institution, you know, Asa Hilliard and others were pushing that. Then you got to push back from the institution about doing that. And raises the point again in relationship to, as you lay this out, how important it is for the teachers to truly teachers and not instructors, but the teachers to be able to understand that they have to, as you're doing, be in the embodiment of that curriculum compared to trying to, at this stage,
right.
to trying to get it passed through the institution. Because as you keep emphasizing, the institutional white supremacy or white hegemony doesn't want, I mean, they are hot. You mentioned SATs. We can deal with the PSSAs. They've invested a lot in the textbooks to be able to reinforce white hegemony. So, right. you know, you come in and you're not strong enough, as you say, Elliot, being a sovereign entity to exert real power to push in spite of, then you get this pushback. And that pushback was fierce. Mm-hmm. I mean, they brought out people from all over to say that I'm thinking of brother in New York from City College.
You talk about Larry Jeffries.
Yes. Because he was pushing the same thing. And Barbara Sizemore, I think it was. She was, emphasizing.
She's another advocate of just like us teaching home. But let me also say this too. I think, so this is ideally, this is really for us. This is something that's for us by us, but I know like a lot of our children are still in the Eurocentric neo-colonial schools. So this is something that can be used in those schools. But just as long as we understand that like the ultimate goal is for us to be independent and have our independent schools. It's kind of like, it reminds me of a lot of this work. It reminds me of like, you know, Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale, their 10-point plan, pending revolution. Like, you know, this is what we're doing right now. Like while we're in this current circumstance, but ultimately, like, you know, we want to have our own schools anyway. And when a lot of these conversations that we end up having, you know, that center around school reform would not even be relevant if we just have our own schools, you know. And that's not something that's going to happen overnight, but I definitely think that should at least be we should be clear that that's the ultimate goal long term.
And I didn't mean to stop. There was African centered word problems where it was the second one.
That's the second element. And it, you know, it allows the students to see themselves in the mathematics. Because one of the things I teach when I'm, you know, whether I'm tutoring or whether I'm teaching about word problems is, you know, read the word problem at least 3 times and also like think about it and try to incorporate yourself into that problem. So take that name, whoever the subject of or the object of this word problem is, take that name out, put your name in it. Think about this in terms of if it was you that was having this experience, because then, you know, now it seems more realistic. So now you can think about like, oh, okay, so this isn't just, it's not as abstract. And I think that also takes away some of the negative stigma around mathematics, because mathematics often is perceived as something very abstract and unrealistic. But doing a thing as simple as just putting your name, putting yourself in it and saying, okay, this is me doing this. This is not this person who's named in this problem doing this. This is me doing, I'm doing this. And then you start to kind of think about it differently. Like, okay, so if I was cooking a meal and, you know, the directions calls for, it says serves 2 people, but I need to, you know, serve 10 people, you know, what would I do? You know, you still got to think mathematically and try to figure that out and follow a process. But now you're thinking about it in terms of what you would do. And you can like envision yourself like, wow, like if I was in the kitchen, you know what I'm saying? You know, and I'm hungry, you know, and I got to cook for some people and I got my pots and I got my pans, you know, I'm, you know, the oven's right there. And, you know, you start thinking of that. Now it's like, okay, this is like a real life situation now, you know? So again, the students being able to see themselves in some of these mathematical problems and then being culturally relevant is just of the utmost importance, you know? And I think whoever designs curriculum, that's what they're thinking about. And that's what they should be thinking about. And I think we just have to do more of that, you know. And some people are already doing this, but I think it has to become more popular for us to do it.
You know, Brother Akil,
learning somebody else's math.
Brother Akil, you mentioned a second ago about math being abstract and unrealistic. Let me ask you a question. Now I'm reflecting back during the time when I was in school. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a great math student, and most of my peers, looking back, weren't great math students. We did have a few in the class. Most of them were young ladies. Do you, as an educator and as a math educator, and talking about lesson plans and the way these things are taught in schools, do you think that the way math is taught to African-American children, by and large, is a way to keep them from really understanding math? Maybe I'm forming that question wrong.
Well,
go ahead.
Definitely. It goes back to the comment I made earlier, like, you know, kind of paraphrasing the late Dr. Amos Wilson. But there's a political necessity around, you know, our children of African descent, performing poorly and underachieving in subjects like mathematics.
Okay.
And one of the things that, you know, I definitely also agree with him about is how you'll notice that, like, every year, it's like the political circumstances are never considered, right? But every year it is like, okay, these test scores are low. And then some so-called smart people get together and, well, I don't know if they're just not that smart or if they're just evil and they know better, but they're like, okay, we got to make it look like we're trying to change this, but we're really trying to just maintain the status quo. I don't know which it is. It's probably a combination of a little bit of both, but there's always some new quick fix, some new technique, some new method, some new technology that we can sell or bring into the school district or something. But the political reality is not considered and not taken into consideration, the overall. And I think that's another thing with histomatics is it addresses the political situation, which is that, like, mathematics has never been marketed to Black people, and it's never been seen as something that's for us. It's always seen as something, oh, that's for them other people. Like, mm-hmm. I commented, I think I was at my, I don't know where I was at, but I was talking about Lisa Delpit and one of the books that she wrote. And the title of one of the books is called Multiplication is for White People. And where she got the title from was she was doing, I think, some practicum work or observing a classroom somewhere. And, you know, she was talking to one of the students. She was a young brother, and like an elementary school age. And the young brother was like, you know, we do, you know, me and my friends, you know, we do addition and subtraction. You know, but the hard stuff, multiplication and division, that's that white people stuff. That's for white people. So, you know, he already made the, you know, he already has been programmed to believe that that's not for him. You know, that's for those other people that he's been also taught that are supposed to be superior to him within this society that he lives in. And that's become his reality. So this is meant to, like, so that part of it is never addressed, right? When we talk about school reform, culturally responsive pedagogy should try to address that, and I think it does. But it's limiting because you got to have a lot of teacher buy-in. You got to have administrator buy-in. You know, sometimes you got administrators that don't want to play ball and don't really care that much. They're just trying to maintain the status quo. You got teachers that don't want to do any extra work. Like with something like this, in order for this to really work, you'd have to really start, like, reading books. A lot of teachers don't even read books. I mean, a lot of people graduate from college never read a book again. I feel like, well, I graduated, so that's why I don't have to read a book ever again. I got a college degree.
Hey, look, I don't know for y'all. You know, I volunteered at a charter school, African Center Charter School. And the thing that disappointed me is two things that, you know, I'm going to throw in there that disappointed me. And besides the point about the administrators, which I agree, was the point that, no, they don't read. But we found that a lot of times the teachers couldn't pass the math part of the praxis. I'm talking about African-American teachers.
Keep feeling it. Keep feeling it. I mean, I think what happens is, you know, one day I would tell my students, like, you know, because I feel like in a lot of schools, especially public schools, there's a lot of school bullying. But I often them to think about the type of school bullying that never gets discussed. And that type of school bullying is the bullying from the administration to the students, the climate managers to the students, the teachers to the students, right? So, you know, because I would hear comments and stuff sometimes too about, you know, these kids and they, you know, they doing so poorly and you know, and the math and whatnot. And I would look at some of them like, a lot of y'all would probably fail the math practice right now. Like, y'all would fail my test. Like, you know, like, granted, our students we need to be developing them so that they have better study habits and better work ethic and perhaps use some different methods to try to drive home these concepts and, you know, these mathematical processes. But I think some of you guys should be a little more humble, because you would fail my class too, you know? So I think, and I think all teachers should be humble in that respect. And I think that all teachers should also embrace the role of a student, because we never know enough. We have to constantly be practitioners and constantly be developing ourselves to try to, you know, hone our craft at all times. There's always something else, you know, to learn, and, you know, in order to be better, to deliver instruction even better, you know? But yeah, but then, so let me go on to number three. Number three, so I got 3, 4, and 5 left. So number three is, this is something I need to develop even more too, is math concepts used as experiential models, right? So again, it goes back to the reading. A lot of times you'll read something and you'll hear these, or you'll read these terms that are not being used in a certain book. They're not being used in a direct mathematical context, but as a math teacher or mathematician, you use that term all the time, right? Like when you talk about like exponents, like someone is a leading exponent of this particular ideology, right? But an exponent is something that's used in mathematical expressions, like 3 to the second power. 2 is the exponent, which means that 3 times 3 equals 9, right? So, or like, you know, like a radical sign, like when I explain how to simplify radicals, right? You know, you break it down, like if you're dealing with a perfect square, like the number 16, like number 16 is a perfect square. So if you take the square root of 16, meaning you're looking for the integer that can be multiplied by itself equals 16, it will be 4. So that we think of the radical sign, this is just something I just kind of just thought of one day. I said, wouldn't it be interesting if I explained radical signs? And I thought about that, and also explained simultaneously what a political prisoner is and how many of our people have been political prisoners, because we can look at the radical sign as a prison. But here we have like a number six, like 16 is a perfect square. So it essentially comes out of the prison, and then the prison is gone. The radical sign is gone, because the square root of 16 equals just 4, just plain 4. It doesn't equal the square root of 4. It equals just plain 4. So the radical sign is gone. So it's almost like that 16 comes out of the prison. And if we're talking about prison and coming out of the prison, like we could talk about Assata Shakur escaping from prison. You know, that's to me an easy connection. And now we can have that conversation. So you have like young brothers and sisters that might have been sitting in the Algebra 1 class or Algebra 2 class that, yeah, they would have learned about how to simplify a radical. But now they also, a lot of them might have never even heard of Assata Shakur ever in life, right? Or they might have never heard of Russell Maroon Schultz, who also came from prison before, right? They might have heard of those two people. But now it's like we're in a math class, and we're talking about simplifying radicals. So now I've also made a connection between political prisoners and how this country treats Black people, and what repression really looks like, and political repression really looks like, and you get to learn a mathematical concept, a mathematical skill at the same time. And the hope would be that any other time you go into a math class and you see a radical sign, you know, something, it triggers something in your psyche and in your mind. You start thinking about Assata Shakur. You start thinking about Russell Maroon Schultz. And now you at least know, like you, at a minimum, you know who these people are. Now you might not do anything with that information per se, or you might do something with it, because now you know who they are,
mm-hmm.
Right? So that's an example of using the math concepts as experiential models, right? And then the last two kind of more straightforward. Like this, number four is the statistics of the African experience. Just using different statistics. And again, going to the reading, you know, and in any like nonfiction text, you know, they're talking about percentages, they're talking about proportions, talking about the numbers of this or that, talking about fractions. These statistics, you know, of our experience, where we center ourselves in the conversation, and then we're talking about the different statistics and what really happened to us and how it's been quantified over time and throughout the years. That's number four. And last but not least, number five, I assigned my students at Cheney a short paper to write. And they were, you know, some of them were like, you know, they were pushing back. They're like, oh, it's supposed to be a math class. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, I want you to, you're going to be teachers. So you need to understand how to impress upon your students, because, you know, you may be teaching in a, you probably will be teaching in an urban school district with our children. So you need to impress upon them that, yes, Black people do math. And yes, Black people have always done math. And since we're at Cheney University, I assigned them to do a short report on Octavius Caddo, who's one of my intellectual heroes. And, you know, because when I was young, I played Little League baseball, right? And he played for the Pythians, the baseball club. And, you know, he was a math professor at the Institute for Colored Youth when it was in South Philly, you know, back in the 19th century. And I was a math teacher. And I mean, even as an educator, I know that those types of stories inspire me, because it makes me want to take, when I started learning more about those people, like I think it was when I learned about him, and then I learned that Sheikh Anta Diop was a mathematician, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
Sheikh Anta Diop was a mathematician, and it's like I had to take a step back and say, wait, hold up, I gotta take this a lot more seriously. Like, you know, because these, you know, I'm part of a lineage, I'm part of a tradition, so I gotta pull my weight, because, you know, yes, some serious people that were involved in this work, like, you know, the late Abdul Aleem Shabazz, that is known as, I think he passed maybe 5 to 6 years ago. He's credited with developing more Black PhDs in mathematics than anyone else in the history of the American educational system. Taught at Lincoln, taught at Clark Atlanta at one point. Actually, I was at a pre-college program. My freshman year of college, I was at Morehouse, my freshman year of college. And in the pre-college program that I attended, he was actually my math professor. And I didn't know, I had no idea who he was. I didn't even know I was in the presence of greatness. I really took it for granted, you know. Ended up running into him like years later at a NCTM, National Council of Teachers of Mathematics conference in Indianapolis, like in 2011. We were sitting in the same session. And I think at that point he was either at Southern or Grambling. I think Southern University. So, and again, another brother that, spent a lot of time in historically Black colleges trying to train Black people to become mathematicians. So again, once you learn about those people, then it's another reason for you to take math more seriously, and for you to think, oh, okay, he's Black like me, you know. Whereas the contrast is in the Eurostream media, you know. Who are the exemplars? Who are the Black men exemplars that our youth are given most aggressively? You know, the athlete, the drug dealer, the rapper. I would say those are the most popular among the youth. Among the youth, you know, from watching the youth over the years, still watching the youth now. You know, who do they idolize? Who do they see as examples? Who are the young brothers right now that are teenagers? 9th grade to 12th grade, 6th grade to 8th grade, what are their examples of manhood? The sisters, what are their examples of womanhood? You know, who are they given? So I think this also, I mean, and we could do this in any discipline. I think it's also just an issue of showing the young brothers and the young sisters some different types of exemplars. And some of the people we got to pull from history, they're obscure. You know, because we don't know about them, and we haven't been told about them. So we got to go do that digging, and do that that research on our own, so then we can have the conversations with the young people and tell them about them. And then, you know, just, and again, it's part of a larger project to like market math to our people. Like mathematics, I realized, like, mathematics has never been marketed to us. Like, so many things have been marketed to Black people, clothes, food and beverage, chicken sandwiches, you know, all these things have been marketed to Black people. But mathematics, and among other things, but mathematics is one of the things that has never really been marketed to us. And I definitely know it's not an accident. There's nothing coincidental or accidental about that. Mm-hmm. But the fact that mathematics has never been marketed to us. If we market it to our people, then things will change. Because we market football, and this is important too, to really think about it in this context. Because again, so you know what Kwame Ture said. One of the things he said is like, anytime you do an analysis of an oppressed people and you leave out the oppressor, you'll always come back with the incorrect analysis. And I think that comment speaks to when people are very dismissive of our people, and they make comments like, okay, nobody's at the back to school night or the report card conference, but everybody's at the Beyonce concert, you know? And it's like, okay, I get it. Yes, that's a problem. But again, we're an oppressed people, and who is responsible for, like, how much of a marketing machine is behind that Beyonce concert? Mm. Versus how much of a marketing machine is behind the report card conference. There's not the same amount of energy that is being directed by many, not all, but by many school administrators and schools in general to get the parents to the report card conference. And I would argue that if the same amount of energy was put forth to get people to the Beyonce concert as they did to get people to the report card conference, then the Beyonce concert would be just as empty.
And, you know, when you bring up your fourth point about the statistics, if we looked at that from the dollars and cents of it, your point is, you know, accurate. I mean, as far as how much money goes into to market those concerts compared to how much money is put into, you know, statistically how much, and you're saying energy, which is another value to evaluate, but when you look at the dollars and cents of it, right, what goes into it to, you know, intentional professionals whose job it is to get people's mind to buy something they don't need.
Right. They're bombarded and assaulted with, you know, this information about these events and in these concerts. Imagine if we did that. Like if we wanted people to come to, you know, the back to school night or the report card conference, and we put forth the same energy and the same resources that people put forth for events and activities that do get a huge turnout, then people will come. So again, to me, it's about marketing.
And the thing that you raised, because I noticed that what people, when they talk about back to school night or which report card night, they're talking about, well, the way to get parents to come out is you got to have food, right? And I believe that strategy might have worked, say, during the time if we looked at Reconstruction, where food was, I mean, there was already a different context of importance for education and the development of young people or everybody being developed compared to now. People can go anywhere and get some food.
Right. What you're speaking to is like, you know, when you mentioned the importance of education, it reminds me of my father, Dr. Brian C. Morrison. His PhD work is on cultural capital. He talks a lot about, wrote extensively about cultural capital and how education was a major source of cultural capital.
Exactly.
Once upon a time, and in the late 19th century and the early, and he specifies and focuses his research on Baltimore City, and in terms of, like, you know, all the things that the Black community in Baltimore City did to educate our children. And you know, the thing is like, you know, there's still some of us where there's always been cultural capital associated with education. And I think to a large extent, one of the problems we have is that there's still a cultural capital associated with education, but it's not
for the same reason. Like, mm-hmm. a lot of, like, even myself, like, when I was younger, I got to the point where I really didn't care about education. I cared about getting a college degree, right? And I wanted the college degree so that I could go out and try to be a capitalist and try to get money and secure the bag, as the people say today, right? Secure the bag, you know, just make money and then go buy stuff and go, you know, kind of, you know, assuage my feelings of inadequacy and insecurity by, you know, giving Europeans the money right back for buying by buying overpriced goods, right? So, but that was, but I knew with the education, you can get the degree. With the degree, you get the job. With the job, the certain job, you have a higher level of disposable income than some other people may have. So then with that, then you can go and kind of so-called live your best life and waste money, right? So there was a value attached to it. It wasn't about building community when I was younger. It wasn't about helping Black people. I often say this. I graduated from Morgan State in 2003. That bachelor's degree, which was in finance, belonged to me, right? That was my mindset. Much more of a rugged individualist back then. My master's degree, I got in 2015 from Lincoln University. By my mindset at that point, that degree belongs to the community. Because I had changed my ideology by that point. If I ever get another degree, it still belongs to the community. Because the goal of that education is to benefit the community, first and foremost. So, and that's, you know, that's just, you know, an issue of, like, you know, so when we think about, like, cultural capital and how we value education and what the purpose of education is for, you know, for a lot of us, you know, we're just trying to, I mean, taking care of your children is fine. Getting money to, you know, provide food, clothing, and shelter, that's fine. But when, you know, you're really trying to go beyond that, you're really trying to ball out, you know, you're trying to become, you know, use your education to parlay that into $1 million just for yourself. You know, that's why I posed that question about, like, some different, like, some ways in which maybe we can modify the way we participate in capitalism, because it is the system. And, you know, I think Garvey had a plan that was worthy of some research and some further review. He said, you know, and he says this back in, like, what, 1915, he said, like, your first $5 million, which was a whole lot of money even for back then. So maybe we can modify that number. Because your first $5 million, he said, to a sole proprietorship owner, your first $5 million should belong to you. You can have that. But anything above $5 million belongs to the community. Like, it has to be used to invest in the community, uplift the community, create programs, create institutions, and so on and so forth.
And that's where I see the added piece that was lost, which, as you say, in relationship to cultural capital is the social capital, because you have to have the network relationship. And I would like to believe that once you have the social capital as the foundation, it creates the cultural capital to where people feel comfortable when it's said, like, after your first $5 million, $20 million, that's yours, that you're going to give it back. Because the relationship is there, trust, those invisible tangibles, trust, the understanding of what the vision is, you know, that is about creating generational relationship more than personal, relationship or personal growth. It's about generational growth compared to personal growth. You need this social network to be secure, so that the cultural network can reinforce that, why it must be maintained, strengthened, and defended. Without that, then you're always, what happened, it would seem, after the, and you can see it, once segregation broke down, the social network, the social capital broke down, and the cultural capital changed from being about the group to being about individuals, as you're saying. And I would argue you can see the evolution of that to vulgar capitalism that we see now and celebrate. Mm-hmm. Jay-Z.
There you go.
Listen,
many others.
Let's take a brief break, and when we come back, for the time that we have left, I'm going to spin off and ask you a question here in relation to a published report that just came out, Brother Akil. And the time we have left, because I want to get your opinion on what's stated, although I know what it might be. It's always good to have the conversation. And the sister that wrote it put some figures with it, which I know you'll enjoy. So we're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation here with Brother Akil Parker, activist educator here in the Philadelphia area. And you can join the conversation, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening.
Time for an Awakening.
With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard the special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. With this new sense of dignity and this new sense of self-respect, a new Negro came into being with a new determination to suffer, to struggle, to sacrifice, and even to die if necessary in order to be free.
Hang on to the world as it spins around.
All our people are righteous by nature, wicked by circumstance, so we are going to try to save our people. Take control of our communities. Anybody that wants justice, come out of those parties that won't give you justice, and let's have a justice party and set up our own candidates, run them in the cities. Take down the weak, blood suckers of the poor, and cast them out, and set up people that will fight for justice for us.
Because there's a whole lot of illusions about Africa's relationship with other people in the world. There's a whole lot of illusions about our relationship to the religions in the world. And these belief systems that had its origin in Africa, all of them, and there is no exception, turned on African people. I said there is no exception. And there's one thing you have to get through your mind and keep it. Nothing that ever came from the European mind was meant to do anything but facilitate European domination of the world. And I said, there's no exception. Everything that was brought into this continent, everything, every idea, every so-called religion, was meant to dominate and to control. The Alps had no illusions about it. The Europeans had no illusions about it. You were the ones with the illusions. And yet every element that went into the making of every major religion in the world started in Africa. Why is it that you are so naive? You let people redress something that you invented, sell it back to you, and enslave you through it.
If we are to defeat the European, if we are to master this earth and take back this earth from the European, then we must outthink the European. We must then be creative. That puts the learning emphasis on the how-ness, the how to think as such, and to the use of knowledge as a tool of mastery. So it's a very different kind of thing. As a result, you see, the control and the paternalism of Europeans over black people. You see, the other thing that we must recognize, even if the European becomes good and nice and accepts us and so forth, the fact that he would still be in control creates a what we might call a benevolent paternalism, which still to a great degree helps to maintain this passive mode of thinking and this passive mode of knowledge.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 9:48 here in the city of Philadelphia, and we're in conversation this evening with activist educator Brother Akil Parker. And for the time we have left, you can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Richard, we're going to stay maybe about 10 minutes extra past 10 because we got started a little late because of a little technical difficulties. That's cool.
No problem.
All right. Brother Keel.
Yes, sir.
Let me, and this is a little off topic, but with the conversation, with the time we have left, I just want your opinion on, and we can spin off into a few other things if you want to. Let me read this article that was published yesterday, in fact. The sister that used to do a program on ESPN that was fired after making statements in reference to Trump. She made statements about black athletes at white universities. And let me share with you some of the information that she put forth. Jameel Hill slammed for urging black athletes to spur white colleges. Former ESPN host Jameel Hill is being slammed as a racist and a pro-segregationist for urging African-American athletes to spur predominantly white colleges in favor of historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs. In her first magazine piece for The Atlantic, Hill contends that black athletes are helping the fortunes of major universities like Michigan, Alabama, Miami, and others, while HBCUs have struggled to compete financially, both in the athletic department and in terms of overall endowment. HBCUs are established before the Civil Rights Act of 1964 in order to provide African Americans a college education during an age of rapid segregation. There are more than 100 such institutions, most of which are founded in the aftermath of the Civil War. HBCUs do not discriminate against non-black students. Black athletes have attracted money. Now, this is a Jameel Hill again, a quote. Black athletes have attracted money and attention to predominantly white universities to showcase them, Hill wrote. Meanwhile, black colleges are struggling. Alabama's athletic department generates $174 million in the 2016-2017 school year, while the HBCU that generated the most from athletics that year, Prairie View A&M, brought in less than $18 million. Beyond sports, the average HBCU endowment is only one-eighth of the average predominantly white school. All of the HBCU endowments combined make up less than one-tenth of Harvard's. She also notes that predominantly white schools' collective multi-billion dollar revenues have been built largely on the exertions of uncompensated black athletes. As Hill explained, the NCAA grossed $1.1 billion in 2017, most of which was generated from Division I men's basketball tournament. The organization extended its media deal in 2016 for an additional $8.8 billion. And there are around 30 Division I schools that make at least $100 million annually in athletic zones. The problem, Hill urges, is that black men make up only 2.4% of the total undergraduate population in the 65 schools that populate the top five athletic conferences, Big Ten, ACC, SEC, Pac-10, and the Pac-12. The flight of black athletes to majority white colleges have been devastating to HBCU, she wrote. What if a group of elite athletes collectively made a choice to attend HBCUs? While Hill's argument has been embraced by some, others criticize her remarks as being racist and pro-segregationist. Hill's coming out as a pro-segregationist is probably the least surprising of anything I've seen this week, one person wrote on Twitter. Conservative Caleb Hull wrote, "Nothing to see here, just Jameel Hill advocating segregation. This is literally racist." The Michigan State graduate was famously suspended from ESPN in 2017 for calling Donald Trump a white supremacist bigot and someone who is unqualified to sit in office as president. later when Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones reportedly threatened to bench any players he saw kneeling in the protest of the national anthem, he'll encourage fans to boycott football games. So, Brother Kill, we see the sisters out here speaking again. She's writing for The Atlantic and writing that black athletes need to stop going to these schools, generating multi-billions of dollars for them while HBCUs are struggling. And the reason I read that is because you mentioned that it was your dream to teach at an HBCU. Your opinion on what she's stating and from your perspective.
So a lot of I was taking a lot of notes as you, I hadn't read the article yet, but I was taking a lot of notes as you were reading.
Okay.
I got to give a shout out to one of my homeboys, brother named Rodney Warren. And this ties into my earlier topic, because he's also a math teacher. He's got a mathematics degree, a black man from down north, North Philly. He was a well-known basketball player in Philly. He's in Arkansas. He ended up going to an HBCU, ended up going to Philander Smith College out in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I bring him up because this is one of the types of conversations that we would have about, you know, because he was a good athlete, and he decided to go to an HBCU when he perhaps could have went to a more well-known white college, perhaps. But, and again, so, it all resonates. But one of the things that I heard mentioned a couple of times was the use of the word segregationist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, again, we have to be very careful with that, because I think a lot of our people fall for that trick. We have to be very precise about the difference between separation and segregation. Mm. I think Malcolm had to explain this many years ago. The issue is power here. The issue is power. And again, like Kwame Ture studied a lot of Malcolm's work and came after him. And, you know, he was very much into power. And I think also we have to be clear about that, too, because I think a lot of times we as a black community, we get caught up in racism, which is really a secondary issue. The issue is really power. Like, you know, the Kwame Ture quote, you know, if a white man wants to lynch me, that's his problem. If the white man has the power to lynch me, then that's my problem, right? So the issue, the fundamental issue is power. Power is where it all hinges on, right? So the separation versus segregation, the difference is in who has the power. What Jemele Hill is talking about is separation, right? Black people having the power to do what they want to do and go to what schools they want to go to. Right. Segregation is when, if Jemele Hill was saying, you white boys, y'all got to go to these schools and y'all can't go, like y'all can't come to HBCUs or y'all can't go to these certain schools. If she had the power, either singularly or within a group of black women or within a group of black people to make that determination, then that would be segregation. If, you know, so there's a difference between segregation and separation. With separation, you have the power, you know, to determine where you go and who you sit by and what you do. With segregation, somebody else has the power, right? It's like with, you know, I do this analogy with my students. Like, and I talk about wide receivers and defensive backs. Like, when the wide receiver tries to create separation, he has the power to do that. He wants to create separation between himself and the defensive back or the cornerback. He's fast enough and he's strong enough to separate, to get away from him. He has the power to do that. Segregation is when somebody else has the power over where you can go and where you can't go. But another point I want to bring up that, you know, I was kind of laughing because, again, you know, this is just, again, back to definitions. So essentially from the responses, if she's called being a racist for advocating for this, for black people going to HBCUs and not going to these white schools that really don't care about them at all anyway, but just using them for their labor, as we've always been used for our labor in this nation. That's their definition of racism. So racism basically is, you know, to white people, it's basically whenever they don't get what they want. Whenever black people don't just lay down and just play their part and just maintain the status quo and just stay in their place, right? That's racism, you know, to them. So if we focus on that, and again, I mentioned Bobby Wright earlier, this is psychopathic racial personality. It's psychopathic behavior. So you define racism that way, in a way that suits you and suits them and suits their goals and their desires. Like, that's not racism. But they want to call that racism. So once they start doing that, then it's like, we can't even take them seriously. you know, at least those people that are saying it. I do want to say, however, things come to mind. I like the idea. Like I said, me and my man, we would talk about, you know, what if it was more high school athletes, world-class, you know, top-ranked athletes from state to state started going to HBCUs. What would that look like? But I think it's something we have to get out in front of and apply some political and economic analysis to, because we should be able to kind of safeguard ourselves in a way where it's not just, well, let's be honest. HBCUs are not perfect. They're not a panacea. Mm-hmm. And even from the beginning, a lot of them have got a lot of their funding from white people anyway, right? Now, what I say is that I think compared to the historically white colleges, we have a better opportunity, especially when we look historically at who HBCUs have produced historically. We have a better opportunity to create some maroon spaces on campus where some serious intellectual work can get done and some serious organizing can get done, and that can lead us to nation building. But even within that, it's not perfect because you got like people like Bill Gates that donated, you know, buying, you know, putting up money so they can get buildings named after them. All these major white corporations, IBM, Apple, are like, you know, dumping money into HBCUs. And that's a dangerous thing. Because, I mean, it looks nice. Your campus looks nice. You got new buildings, new dormitories and everything, but I don't trust it. I don't. It's always some other ulterior motive. It's always some type of hustle going on.
I agree.
That's just looking at the historical precedent. Mm-hmm. When did they really become benevolent toward us? You know, to the point where, you know, we want you to be educated now. You know, and there's with no strings attached, right? So I think we got
to get out in front of this, because even if our most talented athletes start going to HBCUs, how do we safeguard against the Europeans or the white people still being able to capitalize off of that? We got to be thinking about that, because a lot of times we're too trusting, and we don't think about those things. We don't think about, because like I even kind of wonder, like, the first thing that comes to mind, with all due respect to Jemele Hill, the first thing that comes to mind is that this will be publicized in such a way. Because if it's publicized in such a way, as it is, some young black athletes that are in high school right now are going to start thinking about this. And, you know, like, you know, we have to respect, you know, the white people, because they're planners. They're long-term planners. So how do we know that this isn't something that they've been kind of foreseeing already anyway, and they're positioning themselves in a way to be able to still dominate and still
and get capitalize. Get out in front of an issue.
Yeah, this exodus from the white schools into the black colleges anyway. Because if it's just an issue of, well, okay, the black student's not going to the white college, now they're going to the HBCUs, but the HBCU, like the white people double down and now are just still sucking more money out of the HBCUs anyway, like they used to be taking. So now they're taking money out of their own white schools and the HBCUs anyway, we haven't won anything. So now I'm not saying that we shouldn't go to the HBCUs. We should push our children, I think, to go to the HBCUs. But we should figure out some type of way to get in front of this to make sure that we don't just end up in the same type of situation, but we're just at an HBCU now. You know, that's another thing that comes to mind. And then the bigger point, I'm glad, there's a book I read called We Are an African People by Russell Rickford, which catalogs and goes into the independent black schools movement throughout this country in the 60s and 70s. And I was put on to Malcolm X Liberation University, started by Howard Fuller. And it only lasted for maybe 3 years. It was in North Carolina. Initially, it was in Greensboro, and I think he moved to Durham, or maybe it was in Durham first. Then he moved to Greensboro. Lasted about 3 to 4 years. But that was a real grassroots from the people, for the people, for working class adults, black college, right? It wasn't started by white people. Wasn't a land grant institution. So I think that's that type of institution. That's the goal, and that's something that we can still do. We can still do that. Like Howard Fuller did it in 1967, I want to say, maybe 1968. I mean, it was a small institution. Kind of reminds me of what's the other one? Anna Julia Cooper, D.C. I learned about her a little bit after I learned about that school. Frelinghuysen University, named after New Jersey State Senator or representative named Frelinghuysen, who was supportive of the work they were doing. And this was at the time when Anna Julia Cooper was working, teaching in D.C., living in D.C., and they started a college for Black people. So, you know, these are more independent type institutions that I think we should be, you know, leaning towards and thinking about as a community. And even if not a community, but just, you know, a small contingent of us, like us right here, and whoever's listening to this, we should start thinking about like how we can actually start our own colleges. Every college was started by somebody, you know, no matter what the college is. And beyond that, well, another point, I got two more points. One point is like, so there was this brother named Mike Jones. And this has to do with like understanding history and historical context and teaching our youth their history. There's this brother named Mike Jones who had a song called Back Then. And the chorus to the song, this song's maybe about 10, 15 years ago. And the chorus to the song was, you know, back then, y'all ain't want me. He was talking about women and just people in general. You know, it was kind of a, you know, I made it started from the bottom, rags to riches type song, typical hip hop nonsense. But, you know, back then, y'all ain't want me. Now I'm hot. Y'all all on me. So the idea was that kind of like rejecting the people that want him now and want his attention now, but they didn't want his attention before, or they weren't giving him attention before. So when I think of like Black athletes at historically white colleges, I think of how many of them, some may know, some may not even really understand that, you know, once upon a time, you weren't allowed to go to Alabama. Once upon a time, you weren't allowed to go to Miami. Once upon a time, you couldn't go to Ohio State. You couldn't go to Michigan. All these schools that a lot of our top athletes go to, they once upon a time were not even allowed to go there. Now, some people have kind of been indoctrinated with this, like, you know, Negro assimilationist fantasy. So they think that them being accepted by people that once upon a time did not want them represents an advancement for them. But I think that this is a moment where we should strategically apply some egocentrism and kind of say, nah, you ain't want me 50 years ago, don't want me now. You didn't want me 70 years ago, don't want me now. And I think that's something that we can, if we teach our children about that history and even kind of put that out there as something that they, as an option for them, is saying like, nah, like, because I think really it becomes an issue of like, of pride. And I think we have to have enough pride to say, nah, you ain't want me before, don't want me now. And I think that if we can train and develop our youth, especially the star athletes that are going to be sought after by these historically white colleges, then, you know, those white colleges will have a much harder time recruiting any of our children.
No. And I think what goes along with that, and just, you know, because, and it goes back to what you were saying as far as the cultural capital and, you know, the social capital, because we need to have a, you know, looking at it, that they're truly a natural resource. They're wealth builder. Mm-hmm. And if white people are looking at them as wealth builders, we should be looking at them as wealth builders. And if we're looking at them as wealth builders, then we need to have a process, a business process, because, and I'll just give a quick example that just yesterday, a father, son, you know, a scout came to him from a college and said, look, it's kind of late for me to get him a scholarship, an athletic scholarship now, but we can get him. But hold on, because we can get him a teacher scholarship now, because, you know, it's late. What it said to me and what I said to him, it shows they already had a network, a pool, and he's seen it. They had two pools of money. He's seen the talent. He wants the talent, but he knows that the process is already filled up for the pool of money to come in as an athletic scholarship. But he's saying, because we want this talent, we want this resource, you know, we can get him in under this pool of money, which might even be better, because you don't, from what I understand, under an athletic scholarship, if you get hurt, you lose the scholarship. Under a teacher scholarship, you get hurt, you still get the, you can still maintain the scholarship.
So the question of when we're talking about our social capital, do we have, that linear, what is it, vertical and horizontal process for these athletes? So when they, because you have to negotiate all the way through in order to make sure that they get to a HBCU. And even for the HBCU, that ain't like you just getting this talent for nothing.
Right.
There's certain things that you got to do if you want this, because it becomes of a value to you. That's, that model, explaining that model. And I think the smaller narrative to that is what I'm seeing with these parent develop tennis players, these female tennis players. Aren't they just the parents who are doing all in the training and developing them? Coco and what's the other one name? Aren't they just the parents? Or even what initially happened with Venus and Serena, wasn't that just the father who built that natural resource to where they were able to enter into that arena, but they were controlling that process for them? Well, we as a community, we should have that same process. I know here, I use the example of Sunny Hill. Sunny Hill had a lot of talent, basketball talent come through. I guess you know better than me, Elliot, coming through there. But did we have the negotiators to direct them to the supreme talent, to the HBCUs, compared to them choosing on their own, or as you said, Akil, chasing the bag, because they just wanted to get, either wanted to get notoriety or they wanted to get paid. They seen the potential to get paid. They didn't see that in the HBCU, and it wasn't nobody there to help navigate them to that direction. So that social capital, that network, we have to, and that is a political formation, I believe. And that's what I we have to form. And it has to be from that level, because we see them in grade school. We see that supreme talent. Why don't we control that from grade school through high school to college?
Right. And on the other hand too, so I mean, I can see it, I advocate for, my position, supporting historically black colleges and the students attending historically black colleges, but I also can understand how that attending or playing for the historically white college is so seductive, because if you figure your whole life, especially if you if you might have grown up without resources, maybe impoverished, and your whole life everybody's telling you like, yo, man, like you're a great ball player, you're a great basketball player, you're a great football player, and you're looking at these other guys that came from different hoods around the country just like you, and they just kind of, again, followed that kind of conveyor belt that William Roden talks about in his book, $40 Million Slaves.
Mm-hmm.
A conveyor belt, but at the end of the conveyor belt was a bag of money, like a $10 million contract. So then you say, yeah, I want that. And your whole life you've been conditioned to want that, and that becomes your number one goal. And, I mean, you might be well-meaning. You might want to, get your mom out the hood, like a lot of people say, instead of thinking about, getting that money and, building it up around her. That's another conversation, perhaps. But I can see how it could be difficult to turn that down and say, no, I'm going to go to the historically black college and gamble. Because the thing is it's a gamble, but you could do well at historically black college. You could be part of a strong team if a lot of strong athletes are going to the historically black colleges, and then they're still going to the NCAA tournament and doing well. Then you might still go to the NBA if the NBA is the league, and if we haven't started our own league that's competitive and that can pay you well, for your talent. I see how it's difficult. Kind of just,
somebody might look at it as just leaving money on the table, or they might say, they might have elders that are telling like, boy, you crazy. Like, why would you go to this HBCU when you got this school that went to the Final Four last year, sending you letters every day and flying you down there to come visit. They want you to come play, So and then you know what's going to happen after you play for them. After you play for them, then you're going to end up in the NBA or you're going to end up in the NFL. And that's what they've been thinking about their whole life. So I see the difficulty. I know what my position is, but I also understand the difficulty in making that decision when you have that background. So what I think about is how to, again, I see it as going back to education and socialization.
Okay.
What type of socialization process we provide to our youth so that that won't be such a difficult decision? Well, whereas the money, or maybe even the $10 million, it's like, it ain't really worth it. You know what I mean? Like, I could still perhaps go get an education and, do something that that's of benefit to my community. And I can play basketball, but even if I don't get to go to a professional league and play basketball professionally, I can still make a good living and a comfortable living and provide for the community and do something that I feel good about, every day. So these are the things I wonder about when I look at it from the other side or the other perspective.
Yeah, I guess it is a difficult thing for some of these young men and young ladies, but sometimes circumstances drive people to do other things. In the environment on these college campuses now that seems to be growing under this administration might drive people to start looking at other alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
Let me read just share with both of you, Brother Keel and Richard, this article that came out today also. It's about it's taking me just a couple minutes to read this. High-ranking University of Alabama faculty member overseeing student affairs resigned from his position on Thursday after he came under scrutiny for a series of truthful tweets he previously posted about slavery, racism, and American history. James R. Riley, the University of Alabama's now former assistant vice president and dean of students, abruptly quit Thursday afternoon. Students and university leaders confirmed to the school newspaper, The Crimson Tide, which reported the news. He had only worked there for 7 months. He sent out a tweet, and let me read this tweet because he sent it out. This tweet is 2 years old. The flag, the American flag, represents a systemic history of racism for my people. Police are a part of that system. It's hard, is it that hard to see the correlation? This is so disturbing. James R. Riley, the University of Alabama's assistant vice president and dean of students, resigned from his position because Breitbart published his tweets and called him a racist. While Riley's past tweets were not necessarily being blamed for his resignation, he quit after the conservative and many times racist website published his tweets. While Riley's past tweets were not necessarily being blamed for his racism. Excuse me, But a closer look at the tweets in question begs the question, where are the lies? One tweet that he had nearly 2 years old stated about the American flag represents a systemic history of racism for my people. Police are a part of that system. Is it hard to see the correlation? This assertion, of course, is not far-fetched and have been backed up plenty of times by a myriad of reliable sources, not named James R. Riley. Another tweet, also from 2017, addressed white privilege and the myth of reverse racism. The tweet, I'm baffled about how the first thing white people say is that that's not racist, when they can't even, when they haven't even experienced racism. He tweeted in October of that year. You have no opinion. it is clear that the whole role of the University of Alabama administration played in Riley's resignation, but the fact that he had only worked there 7 months and quit so abruptly suggested his experience on the Tuscaloosa campus had been anything but welcoming. The school has been regularly involved in racist incidents in the past recent years, including hateful videos starring white students who were throwing around the N-word. Last year, a student organization booked a white supremacist to speak on campus about all things diversity. Never mind the fact that Alabama Governor Kay Ivey just apologized last week for participating in a racist skit while wearing blackface in college. So, you know, I'm just throwing it out there because you see the environment that's happening on a lot of these campuses, and that might start getting some of our people to start looking at these things differently. I know that all of them won't, but some of them will.
This European that we're up against is very, a very shrewd individual.
Mm-hmm.
As these events start taking place and more, there's more overt racism expressing itself on these campuses, and as more of us move to the historically black colleges or start going back to the historically black colleges, like I said earlier, we have to figure out a way to get in front of this thing, safeguard ourselves so that we don't end up in the same, I guess the same situation or the same circumstances, except more of our students are at the HBCU. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I guess that's just more. That's more. So we can never just chill and think, okay, we won now. Like, unfortunately, a lot of times we kind of fall into that. Like, okay, cool. Like we winning now, but not knowing that. Nah, they got something for that too. You know, it's like what they say. They don't get you in the wash, they'll get you in the wrench. You know, so we got to be more strategic with how we move. Cause we got to figure, okay, when we do this, this is what they're going to do. And then when we do that, they're going to do this. And when they go that, we're going to do. So a lot of times we just feel like, okay, yeah, this is a problem. This is bad. All right, let's react and go do this. And then we think, you know, we safe now. We cool now. But actually, they got a plan for that. They got something to counter that move too. So I just think we just got to be thinking about that. But what did you mention? Like, it was at the University of Alabama. Is that what you said?
Yeah. No.
Yeah, yes. So you mentioned diversity or the diversity program they have. And I just look at diversity as 2017, 2016, 2018, 19 word for integrationism, which is, you know, and again, I go back to the ancestors. Kwame Ture said in a speech in the 60s when he was still young, the integration is a subterfuge for the maintenance of white supremacy. So all it is, it's like, you know, it's one way integration. It's like, oh, you want black people to come, you know, you might let some black people come into the white neighborhood, but the white people aren't trying to come live in the black neighborhood. It's not bi-directional. And a lot of that is, again, because I think we need independence. We need a nationalism of our own. We really need pan-Africanism. But what these things, what these diversity initiatives do is it keeps us away from building for ourselves, because it says, here, look, come work for our company, you know, come be in our programs, you know. So if that's the environment and that's the political climate, then a lot of people won't even stop to think like, wait, like, nah, we really should be building for ourselves. Why would you build for you? So again, it's a response to movement toward independence. You know, they just call it, these days they call it diversity. Diversity is it's a scheme. You know, it's really a scheme because it's not really that diverse. I mean, you can be a black face, you know, but what about, you know, your culture won't be embraced though. Mm. You know, and I don't think you can have real diversity until you have power of your own. Then once you get power, then when you're so-called sitting at the table, you're respected as an equal at that table. I think what people try to do is they want to sit at the table without any power.
Okay.
And then you end up being beholden to the other people that are at the table that already have power. then you're only allowed to do what they allow you to do. You can't stop them from doing anything. They can stop you from doing stuff because they're basically just doing you a favor by just letting you sit there because it's at the table. And that's another thing, too, I've been thinking about, like this concept of the table. This table, this proverbial table that we keep talking about a lot more recently is the white man's table. I think language is important. And when we say the table, we're essentially saying that the white man has the only table. Mm. As if we as blacks cannot have our own table. And I think that kind of thinking and that use of language gets into our mindset. And then we end up reinforcing this white domination or white supremacy theory that they have the table. And that the table that we need to get to is their table. Instead of saying, nah, you know what? We're about to go over here and build our own table. Figure out a way to get some resources, we're going to build our own table. Now, that's probably, in many cases, will be a very difficult thing to do. But a lot of us don't even get to the point of even thinking about the possibility of doing that because we're so fixated on getting to this white man's table that we call the table. See, that language, like we talked about language earlier, the definite article, the indefinite article, are very important words that it affects meaning. When you start thinking of something as singular and the only one, that'll affect how you move. You'll be fighting to get to that one. Like imagine like a bus is coming. Like I remember like when we was younger in middle school, waiting for the bus after school, and the first bus to come up, and everybody be fighting the crowd on that bus. But then, and be fighting and, pushing people and everything. And then they end up getting on the bus and they smashed up against the door closed. They smashed up against the door all uncomfortable. And some of us were smart enough to be like, you know what, listen, that's not the only bus. We're going to chill. We'll wait 5 minutes. Another bus is going to come through. And a lot of times the next bus that comes will be damn near empty. And we get on that bus and just kind of chill. And just everybody got a seat and everything. But those guys, they thought they kind of approach the situation like that was the only bus, So, I mean, it might be like an oversimplification of the circumstances that we're in, but I think that's something that we need to start thinking about. And definitely, like, these are conversations that we have to start having with our children, because our children are hearing all these terms and cliches and tropes thrown around, and a lot of times they're not given the proper context, and they're not in a space where they can kind of challenge the meaning and challenge them because they don't really understand. They just think like, oh, okay, yeah, it sounds good. Well, I heard my dad say this, or my uncle say this, or my grandpa say this, so it must be right, But maybe, their uncle, their dad, their granddad, whoever might be well-meaning, but they might not have applied any real critical analysis to the situation. So, I think that's where we come in to try to, again, change the level of dialogue to get people to start having some cognitive dissonance and start challenging some of these preconceived notions that we've held on to for so long about a lot of these things we just accept as true.
And I think I would like just to add that I think the especially in the context of what you're developing and before we go, because you went to number four, I just want to make sure we catch number five. For the record, Elliot, if you wouldn't mind, some point we could probably get Brother Keel come back and elaborate on it. But I just thought it would be important to have that what you're laying out since you're developing it. It's important to be a part, if you don't mind, be a part of that development. The listening audience and Time for Awakening audience to be a part of that. So look, that was one thing, but I think what you have laid out, and I think that's important for us to understand, and we have to be more confident because there is a maroon itch community that has a different perspective than what I call the Atlantic community. And the maroon itch community may numerically be small, but it doesn't have the same confidence as the Atlantic community because it's always looking at the Atlantic community who's chasing the white hegemony or under white hegemony. But the Maroonish community has always been saying, we need to be able to feed, clothe, shelter, and define our reality and our process for ourselves and protect that. That's different than being integrated or being at somebody else's table. And it just seems that what you're laying out as far as the educational process, being able to tie the mathematics and the history as a teacher to educate students, you're really emphasizing the Maroonish community, like where you say, where these homeschool collectives, it would work more effectively, even if those, for those parents who are taking a Maroonish position, they are saying, I'm not tied to any structural system. So could you imagine the support system that they would have with teachers like yourself having this kind of orientation in teaching those children? What parents would feel and what children would know, students, scholars would be developed out of that over and a generation or two. And you don't need a large community, as other communities show, to be a power community. You know, you just need to be effectively organized,
right,
to be a power community. So what is that the fifth element to the...
You
said statistics of African experience.
That was the fourth one. The statistics of African experience is the fourth one. The fifth element is just like African freedom fighters and African American.
I see what you're
saying. Of importance that were mathematicians or mathematically empowered. When I say importance, I mean, it doesn't mean they were famous, because I mean, there's a lot of people that were very important that we never heard of. You know, may never hear of, or they may just be known locally or just in somebody's community or whatever. But just people that, you know, kind of, we don't know them as having a connection to mathematics. Like, I think about like W.E.B. Du Bois, very, very popular, very well known. Many people haven't really studied his work as deeply as they should have. And maybe some of the people that hate him a whole lot, maybe they think differently if they like kind of studied his work more. But even when he had contradictions, we all have contradictions, though. But Booker T. Washington offered him an opportunity to be a mathematics professor at Tuskegee. So when I read about that, I never thought about him in that light. I thought about him as a sociologist, a historian, civil rights activist later on, writer for the crisis. But I never made the connection between Du Bois and mathematics.
Political economy, having that political economic background.
Yeah, I just never made. I was naive. I just never thought of that connection. Till I was studying him more, and so these are the types of things. Like, so you know, Du Bois could have been a math professor. The only reason he didn't take the position is because he had already accepted the position from Wilberforce, and he ended up going to Wilberforce and doing the work that he did up there. At Wilberforce, and somebody else. I was studying Adam Clayton Powell Jr. I didn't know that Adam Clayton Powell Jr. had a mathematics degree from Colgate University. You know, you think of Adam Clayton Powell Jr., you think, you know, politician, very charismatic, you know, down for the black people in Harlem. You know, he has some of his own contradictions too, but I didn't know these people studied mathematics. And we're degreed in mathematics. Anna Julia Cooper, I mentioned her earlier. She has a master's degree, I think, from Erb Oberlin in mathematics. You know, just a lot of different people. And of course, like the Octavius Caddos that are obscure and a lot of people don't know about him. Kelly Miller, who was an administrator at Howard, but a mathematics professor as well. And also kind of, you know, tied into a lot of things that were going on politically within the black community in the early 20th century. You know, he had some disagreements with Hubert Henry Harris. I can't recall exactly. Maybe he had some disagreements with Hubert Henry Harrison or it was Marcus Garvey himself. I'm not sure. But I mean, again, so when we're in a mathematics class, we're talking about these people, and you know, these people and their connection to the math class is the fact that they were connected to mathematics. Because I think, you know, I was talking to some people at the teaching Black History conference, and shout out to LeGarrette King. LeGarrette King is the organizer of that conference. He teaches at University of Missouri. But talking to some people, kind of like after my session when I presented, and I kind of was like, you know what, like for real, a lot of times I'd be in class and I'm like, I really want to talk to y'all about, like, okay, I know this is a geometry class, and I know we got to have this conversation about alternate interior angles and transversals, but I really want to talk about Asada Shakur right now. That's just what I really want to do right now. That's just this me right now. That's how I feel. I really want to talk about Cuban Henry Harrison right now. You know what I mean? Like, I really want to do that, you know, but I got to figure out a way to, you know, be able to do both. And I guess this whole thing, like, program and this whole framework is kind of like a formalized way to justify and rationalize, I guess, if somebody asks, like, why are you doing, like, Mr. Parker, why are you doing this? Why are you having this conversation? Well, this is why I'm having this conversation. This is the relevancy. This is how it's connected to this mathematical standard. And this person did this and this person did that. You know, if you got to, you know, have that conversation with somebody. But just on a very just fundamental level, like sometimes as a teacher, I just want to, and I know my students need that. My students need to develop their mathematical aptitude. They also definitely need to develop the historical and cultural and political awareness. And I think by connecting it to the history opens the door to develop the political awareness, the cultural awareness, the economic awareness. So then, you know, we can talk about, like, why things in the community are the way they are, you know, or why are we experiencing some of the things we're experiencing? Because historically, things have been like this, and this was the decision that was made by these people, and this law was passed, or this policy was implemented, you know, this many years ago, or, you know, just all these types of things. But, you know, again, like, connecting it to, so the fifth element, again, is, you know, connecting history to, or historical figures, you know, to mathematics. Like, you know, like I mentioned earlier, like, when I found out that Dr. Sheikh Ottajoe was, you know, a mathematician, you know, that makes me think of STEM totally differently. Because as I say, like, STEM is like, STEM initiatives in the Black community are very cute, but they're not serious. You know, because it's really just about, yeah, okay, we can have some more math programs, some more robotics programs. We can, you know, fly some drones, basically play around. And then maybe some of those Black students that, you know, Black children get exposed to that, by, you know, these, you know, funding from white liberal nonprofit organizations or whoever, then they may go to college, but then they're going to come and work for those same white people. And while they're doing that, our community is never going to be developed. You know, if all of our young people grow up to go do that, and if that's the goal, that's the aspiration. You know, so that's why, like, when the STEM becomes real, like, STEM becomes real for us when STEM is seen as a tool for us to nation build with.
Okay.
It's gotta become that.
Well, Akil, listen, I want to thank you for being with us. And listen, you know the door is always open to come back and talk about issues, talk about anything you want, to be honest.
You know what I want to do? I want to plug in. I mentioned my father, Dr. Brian C. Morrison, and his work on cultural capital. So if you want to talk about cultural capital and education, I think y'all would have a really fruitful conversation on that, and like some of the work he's done. And like I said, he's been in education for almost 40 years. So, you know, if you're interested, I can make that connection. If you'd like to do that.
Yeah. In fact, I think you got my email. I know you got Richard's. Send me over some of his stuff. I'd love to read it.
Okay. Definitely. I'll let him know. I'll let him do that.
Okay. That sounds good. Great.
Yeah. And I definitely would be interested in seeing it. Great, man. I think we I would really like to see. I think I'd really like to see this here, how you're going to continue to develop, you know, this concept, because we're talking in the chat is like, this is the type of teachers that we need, I believe, you know, that, yeah, that can do both in the different subject areas. You know, so.
Yeah, I wrote looking at her. I think that's critical too. Like you mentioned the type of teachers that we need. And again, in terms of being strategic and getting out in front of things, you know, when we're trying to respond with a remedy to a problem. Another thing, you know, I wrote about this recently, about the initiative to increase the number of Black male school teachers. And again, when, you know, the Europeans start to support some of these things, we gotta look at it, you know, sometimes with a jaundiced eye, you know, be real critical.
I was gonna bring that up, but that takes another discussion.
Real quick though, you know, I wrote about that, how it's not gonna matter if we increase the number of Black male school teachers if those Black male school teachers are possessed of the same exact ideology that the school teachers that you're attempting to replace them with. And that's another thing too. See, we don't look at this type of thing mathematically. We kind of look at it like there are all these empty classrooms. And I mean, some of them, you know, do have substitutes every day in a lot of schools, unfortunately, throughout the country. But when we get serious about increasing the number of Black male school teachers, that's going to mean some of these white women got to go, and some of these white men got to go. And that's a real conversation. That's when the rubber is. That's a real conversation that I think people aren't ready for. They're just kind of like the whole, well, it's only 2% Black male school teachers, so let's just increase the number of school teachers. Well, I mean, if your cup is full, and you know, where are you gonna put more juice at?
Mm-hmm.
You gotta dump some out first. You know what I'm saying? Like, so, and I think that's another part of the conversation that we have to start having. Because really, this is really economic warfare. It's about labor. And when we talk about Brown versus Board, what happened with Brown versus Board is a lot of Black teachers and Black administrators lost their jobs.
Right.
As a result of the way Brown versus Board of Education was implemented. So, and that was that provided an opportunity for more white people to get jobs. And I think that's what a lot of times in this country that has happened. I mean, that's like civil war. Okay, you want to end chattel slavery. You don't want to end chattel slavery because you love Black people and you think we should be treated as humans. You want to end chattel slavery so white men can get jobs. Because the rich white men down south would rather have an enslaved African do that work than hire a white man to do that work. So, I mean, again, when we go beneath the surface and we get deeper into the conversation about, like, you know, again, all these things that sound good in theory, but when we start to really unpack them, we start to look at, okay, well, then we still got to, but what about this part over here? What about this part over here? You know, it's real messy. And we got to deal with it. And we got to deal with it. Because, you know, our children's lives and our children's future and future of our race is really at stake.
I agree. You know? Brother Keel, we'll talk to you soon, man.
All right.
All right now. Peace.
Peace.
Peace. Take it easy.
All right. Mm-hmm. Richard, interesting conversation, man, with Brother
great.
Keel. And I'm looking forward to having a conversation with his dad and reading some of his, you know, his papers, his literature.
I haven't, but I'm definitely going to look into it. So, because it fits right into what I believe and understand and what we have to do. So I'm glad that he mentioned it. And, you know, it's just interesting, you know, by this talk, I get to know more about Brother Akil. You know, here is Baltimore is rich. You know, Philly gets his props, but Baltimore has is prop too. And I was going to mention to him that one of the people that come out of Baltimore is Hezekiah Grice, which he 19th century leader, but it was him that started the Negro conventions, you know, that came to Philadelphia and said that, but he was also pushing for citizenship rights in, you know, that because Baltimore was a place that was challenging, wanting to challenge the whole thing of free Africans having citizenship rights. And he did, he went through a, he created a whole a series of things. So, you know, and Birthright Citizenship, the book Birthright Citizenship, Martha Jones, I think fully, more fully develops, Hezekiah Grice, as a person, but in looking at him and looking at other people, you know, that come out of Baltimore, and it's Wichita gave Baltimore a bad rap, but when we stay centered to Africans, historical center, Baltimore has, produced some, dynamic individuals, and is obviously still producing, dynamic individual. It's in, what's his name that did the article on reparation is out of Baltimore. And I can't think of his name right now.
Okay.
Yeah. So yes, I'll definitely be interested.
All right. Well, we come to the conclusion of another program. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion. As always, we'll be back on Sunday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of.
friend. Soon it will be their chance to try and save the world. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. To save the children. To save the children.